This is the smell of a warm 3-day-old egg salad sandwich in a wimpy trash bag.
Wimpy, wimpy, wimpy!
Blech! And this is the smell of that same sandwich in a hefty, ultra-strong trash bag with new Fabuloso lemon scent.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Smell the difference? When life gives you stinky, get hefty, ultra-strong with new Fabuloso lemon scent. It smells like clean, freshly picked lemons. So no matter what's inside your trash, you can stop the stink and smell the lemon.
This week on Happy, Sad, Confused, John Boyega on Detroit, Star Wars, and fighting monsters in Pacific Rim Uprising. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to my podcast. Sammy's here with me as always. Hey, Sammy.
At least some things are the same.
Some things are the same. So, okay, first, we have to apologize. We took a week off. Lots happened.
A lot has happened.
We were at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
We both survived.
Barely.
We're not the same people.
Truly.
Are you the same person?
No.
I'm a shell of a man. And I was already a shell of a man going into Comic-Con.
Yeah, so now you're just like a thin layer. Thin exoskeleton.
I'm barely here, guys. I'm hanging on by a thread. But we had a blast at Comic-Con. If you guys haven't checked out like the 30 or so interviews we did over 3 days there, I think almost every single one is up on MTV's YouTube page,
yes,
right?
They should be.
If not, heads
theoretically,
will roll.
Yeah,
I think they all are. They were a lot of fun. And I don't even know what the highlights were. The highlight was surviving. What was the highlight for you? Was Sam and Cat, right?
Outlander. Guys, they're amazing.
They were fun. They were good.
We were like their first interview that day, but Sam had already gone to the gym, as we confirmed. I was very curious if he had gone to the gym that morning. And they were just so lovely. They're real people.
Sammy was very nervous. It was her first time being in a room with Sam.
My hands were sweating, like legitimately.
Sam, if you're listening, she played it cool. I think you would agree.
She did
a good job. But just know you should really be careful around her because
when
obsessed.
He left the room, I did have to like exhale. I've been holding my breath for like the full 20 minutes, but
oh my god! So that was fun. Yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff in that. So check that stuff out. And meanwhile, so this week's episode, we should say, is John Boyega, and we should say also some kind of like housekeeping, kind of general things about Happy, Sad, Confused. So yes, we took a week off partially because of Comic-Con and partially because we are kind of in a little bit of a transitional period. The truth is that MTV, as Happy, Sad, Confused listeners who've listened for a couple years now, 3 years now probably, we've been on the air. The podcast kind of began before coming to the MTV Podcast Network. We brought it over to MTV when they launched their podcast network. They've made some changes over here. They decided not to pursue podcasts full-time here for a while. The good news is Happy, Sad, Confused will continue. There are discussions underway with some other folks that are interested in hosting Happy, Sad, Confused.
The White House.
Yes. Mr. Trump is very interested. I'm the new communications director,
Big
by the way.
Big fan of the show.
The mooch is out. Horowitz is in. No. So fear not. Happy, Sad, Confused will continue. It won't, I think, sound any different to you guys. It's just going to maybe have a new home very soon. And in the meantime, we're going to try to continue publishing as regularly as possible. It might not be once a week. It might take a little time to kind of get back on the regular. But again, fear not, we're okay. And the good news is we are back this week with a guest that I've wanted to have on for a while, which is John Boyega.
He's got a couple things happening for him.
John's doing really well. Yeah. John, of course, hit it big a couple years ago with Star Wars. But before that, and we talk about this, for those that haven't seen Attack the Block, you really should. It came out in, I think, 2011. Was this like cool, crazy kind of like alien invasion movie in the hood kind of a thing, like a weird kind of juxtaposition of like you don't usually see aliens like hitting like urban environments and like and the kind of characters you don't actually see in those kind of movies. And John, that was his big screen debut, and he really popped on the big screen there. It took him a few years to kind of find the next big thing, but what a thing it was in playing Finn in Star Wars The Force Awakens. And since then, he has not wasted any time in just grabbing opportunities where he can. He just finished a run on stage in the West End. He shot the new Pacific Rim movie, which he's also a producer on.
Wow.
Isn't that impressive?
John.
I know. Crazy. And most importantly for this podcast, he's starring in a new film, a really powerful new film called Detroit, which is directed by the amazing Catherine Bigelow, of course, Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker. And for those that don't know, this is it's a super intense story. I feel like all the movies I've been seeing lately, by the way, have been intense. Between Dunkirk and Detroit. I saw Wind River last night, which is a great movie.
You gotta go see Girls Trip or something.
I know. I deserve a Girls Trip.
You deserve a Girls Trip.
But Detroit tells the story of what happened at the Algiers Hotel nearly 50 years ago to this day during the riots in Detroit, where three African-American young men were murdered in cold blood by police officers, and it's a tragic story. It's hard to comprehend, and thanks to Catherine Bigelow's immersive kind of verite approach to the material, it really puts you in that situation. And it's especially like the second act of the film, kind of this like central 45 minutes or hour where kind of like all the shit goes down. It's pretty harrowing to watch, but it's an important film. I had the opportunity to do a Q&A with the entire cast.
Okay. You've been doing a lot. You've been in this world a lot.
I know. I need a break.
Yeah.
No, but it was one of the more. I don't know if they're going to put this online. I'll let you guys know on the next episode if they ended up doing it. I did a screening at Screen Actors Guild where it was the whole cast and Catherine Bigelow, and it was frankly one of the more emotional kind of Q&As I've ever been a part of. Huge standing ovation and just like people on the verge of tears. It's that kind of movie. So it's not a light evening at the movies, but it's really an important one, and it obviously has relevance to the kind of incidents that keep popping up these days. So we talk at length about that, and but also just sort of a, you know, charting out his career at the, I think he's just like 25 years old, and he's got such a good head on his shoulders and a good spirit to him, and it's been good to get to know John over the last couple of years, and thanks to Star Wars and these other opportunities, I know we'll be talking a lot.
Did you tell him that Daisy's on the end of this podcast?
Oh, I didn't mention it.
This is why I need to be on every shoot with you. You forget all of the important things.
Damn it.
He would have loved that.
Oh, I think I mentioned Daisy's done the podcast, but I didn't mention that specifically.
Oh, cool. Daisy's done a podcast.
Okay. Let's get to the main event. Remember to check out Detroit. It's in theaters right now. I believe it's going wider this Friday. So you have no excuse. Go check it out. And enjoy this conversation with John. And keep sticking with us. Happy Stay Confused. We're going strong, guys.
Yeah, don't give up on us.
Don't give up on us. Don't we're not giving up on you. and without any further ado, here's John.
You like what I've done with this room?
Yeah.
It's subtle.
Oh, you did this?
Yeah. It was all white and boring before I came in. And I brought this for you, John. I think we're off and running, right? We're good?
Right.
Excellent. John, it's always good to see you, man.
Good to see you.
You've had a busy couple of years. And I want to get a sense, first of all, I mean, it's kind of an exciting time for you in that I feel like we're starting to see, obviously, the Star Wars stuff we've been seeing, mm-hmm. but we're starting to see what's come out of Star Wars and mm-hmm. the choices you made mm-hmm. in the wake of that insane opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
Namely Detroit, which is what we're here to talk about primarily. But I'm just mm-hmm. curious, out of that opportunity, out of the Star Wars whirlwind, mm-hmm. did you make kind of like a list of priorities? Like, okay, this is what I want to do now with this opportunity that's at my feet? Or how do you approach things?
I'm a selfish audience member. I like watching so many films from so many different genres, and I just wanted to be in projects that I like to watch, and I'm just trying to tick as many off as possible and collaborate, obviously, with the best, and Star Wars gave me that opportunity.
Yeah.
So when Detroit came along, I was just like, I'm not going to wait until this trilogy to be over before I start to go towards versatility, and I feel like I have the skill set to do so. So Detroit served itself as another opportunity, but with much more purpose for me.
What kind of purpose? What are you talking about there?
Because it's about an issue that obviously, you know, hits home to many of us all around the world, and at the same time, it's a chance to watch Catherine Bigelow at work. And I just set up my own company, and I have strings behind the scenes, and I'm getting my feet warm in terms of just exploring it. Other creative choices I can make, and seeing her work and seeing that she has come to that stage in which she has that creative freedom. Obviously, I was inspired by her on a day-to-day basis. So.
Yeah.
Detroit was a great opportunity.
She's someone that, I mean, for any film fan, they followed her from early in her career, whether it was films like Near Dark and Point Break. But certainly in the last couple films, she's hit this insane groove where she's, you know, dealing with the world that we're living in now and putting her lens on it and putting audience members, like, creating such an immediacy of these, like, fraught moments. I mean, it's the sustained tension when I think of Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, and especially Detroit, frankly. Like, the second act of this film is insane. It's like
you're
the audience member is there with you guys.
Yeah.
I mean, is that something? I guess my question is sort of like, what is the Catherine Bigelow environment? What were you hoping to get out of the experience, and what did you in fact get out of the experience?
Well, what you find if you've watched at least Zero Dark Thirty or The Hurt Locker, she strips movies of that kind of, I don't know how to articulate it, but it's like a Hollywood rhythm. Bad things happen, good things happen, peace, calm, middle, you know, beginning, middle, end. She strips all of that and just goes reality.
Yeah.
And that's the issue. That's what makes it so, you know, sometimes you have to be emotionally engaged with a Catherine Bigelow movie at all times. You're kind of, it's strange. You're drawn towards that. So if you as an audience member feel like you have to emotionally work to just keep on top of the characters and the story, then as an actor on set, it's a whole different level of work ethic. But at the same time, it's enjoyable because, you know, I come from you know, the UK, in which in drama school, craft is kind of like held as number one. You've got your craft set, and you've got the opportunity, you've got the chance to do something, and she just creates an environment that just makes you a better actor.
Yeah,
I think she could make a cat win an Oscar.
I feel because that's the challenge for the next film. Her Talking Cat movie is going to be amazing.
Talking Cat movie, Catherine Bigelow directing. Not my idea.
No, that was my horrible idea. Get a picture to her later. I need your backup.
No. I'll voice one of the other characters. Yeah. We got something going on, mate.
So John and I were talking earlier. To be honest, he thinks it's a horrible idea, but I think he's gonna come around.
Re-edit of Detroit, no John Boyega.
The only thing that Detroit was missing was a talking cat.
Oh.
No, so I mean, it's funny because when I think of you and the experiences I've had talking to you, you have such like a big personality. You obviously kind of like are enjoying this moment and you kind of making the most of it. And like this can't be, you know, and it's a job, right? You're not there to have fun, but it can't be necessarily a fun experience. I think of someone like Anthony Mackie too, who's also like I'm sure you guys like got along like gangbusters because he's similarly like the biggest personality I've ever met.
Anthony Mackie like a box of skills, just running around the world, just sharing his happiness and jokes. He's a great laugh and a good spirit.
Yeah.
But
do you have to stifle that though on this?
No,
do you
kind of... but there's fun comes in different shades to me, but working on this kind of level and this kind of intensity is fun to me, because after you've done a take and you see, you know, Catherine's eyes light up and you're like, no, do you feel like you've got it? And she's like, yes. And that to me is
That's the joy of it.
Yeah, it's the joy of it. And especially knowing that, you know, these cameras represent millions of people all around the world who will eventually see this movie. We're secretly filming it, you know, in Boston in a you know, building and no one's around, and you know, one day everyone's going to see it. So it requires a commitment, and that commitment is for me enjoyable. And her process just made this a great experience.
Yeah,
one that I will never forget. I'm sure.
I'm sure that you also have to build like a camaraderie with that kind of cast when you're in kind of these intense situations.
Yeah, especially after seeing, we'll come up to each other. You know, I'd always get a pat on my back saying, "You okay? Yeah, everything cool." And it felt good.
So talk to me a little bit about, you know, I was telling you before when you came in, I recall talking to you the first time was in 2011, I think, at San Diego in Comic-Con, and Attack the Block was this amazing film. If people haven't seen it, they need to see it. Yeah. Joe Cornish, who, by the way, still hasn't directed another movie. What the hell's going on?
I think
on
he's
there?
Got something in now.
That's what Edgar had said when I spoke to
Joe, him. Joe, don't mess around, man.
So talk to me. Here's what I'm curious about. Coming off of that opportunity, which I think was your first feature, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and there's been there was a gap between that and Star Wars.
Yeah.
Obviously. You were working, you were a working actor, but like out of Attack the Block, out of Comic-Con, were you like, I'm set, I'm good? Like,
I still didn't have stateside representation, which is very important in breaking this industry here, is to have a team here that, that can lead you in terms of guiding roles and getting the opportunity. I did a pilot for HBO called The Brick with Spike Lee that didn't go to season. So that was like...
That's got to be a little...
That was a bummer. Yeah. So after that, I kind of left America alone. And I went back home and I started... I'd done a few things back in the UK. And then I came back out to the States many times. I was back and forth, just auditioning, meetings, trying to make something happen.
Did I hear correctly? You were like on the shortlist up for Kingsman. That one almost
happened. Yeah, yeah. That Kingsman almost happened. The Maze Runner almost happened, and they didn't. You know, that was a huge bummer at the time.
Does it get easier, or does it each one of those sting and like? Because you know what?
No, because I guess it, like so. Maze Runner was particularly hard because I stayed in LA with no money because I had overstayed my accommodation, and then they kept on bringing me back. So I stayed on my friend's couch, and I'd lost my accommodation elsewhere on the hope that obviously we were down to like the last two, and
right,
you know, at the time the team was very keen that, you know, it would go through, and it didn't. So I was kind of like, ah, I gotta go back to London now with like, you know,
yeah,
chewing gum.
You could audition.
And explain to my parents what the hell you went to LA to do.
Well, let's talk about your parents. I mean, growing up, because as far as I know, the business, as whatever we want to call it, it's not in your family.
No.
At all. Mm-hmm. Like, anybody in your family have any aspirations to act, write, whatever?
No one cares about that.
They still don't? They're still not into it?
No.
Really?
No.
That's probably good for your head.
I mean,
maybe
it's fine.
You're like, it'd be nice if they cared a little bit.
I mean, they care to the point of like, you know, what are you doing next? Okay, cool, great.
They want you to be happy.
Yeah, as long as I'm working, yeah. My dad enjoys watching projects. You know, my dad's a big fan. He's a big Boyega fan. He even has T-shirts with my face on it. He wears in the house.
What is it? Just your face? That's
yes, it? Yes, if there's a Finn T-shirt with me shooting a blaster, it's got a long strip of blue. My dad wears it sometimes. It's with his pajama bottoms. It's an interesting sight.
I'm sure.
Most parents don't have that.
No.
But...
my parents have the same T-shirt.
No, yeah, do they? He's really a big fan. But it's for me, it's just I don't know. It's a normality that they have, and I like that they don't necessarily care to an uncomfortable point. They're cool with it.
Well, so when did you start to make your intentions known or kind of fall in love with acting?
Very young age. I was in primary school, and I did a performance in front of one of my teachers for like a school project, and I just felt at home. I mean, football wasn't for me, sports wasn't for me. The only time I was glorious at sports is when I scored an own goal. You know, I scored for the enemy. And I was just like, wait, no, I was on the other team anyway.
I still get credit for it, come on.
Yeah, I was on the other team anyway, that was what I was doing. Horrible day, everyone laughed. But when I was acting, I felt like that this was me, and I was given the opportunity to go to Theatre Peckham to study. And from then, I was just exposed to all of it.
What do you think you were enjoying at first? Was it just an escape, a aptitude? Like, oh, I'm actually good at this, so I'm going to pursue this. The attention's nice. I mean, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. I'm an actor as long as people get to see me. To be honest with you, like, I like to act, but I like to act with an audience.
Right.
So the audience play an important part of what we do. And that to me was the reactions, how engaging they were. It was inspirational. I felt like this is my niche. I feel like the king when I'm doing this.
And you said,
and then when you stop, you're back to normal.
then you're back to thinking about
the soccer game. Yeah, yeah. Then you're just like, oh, I can't play there. Because you can't act during recess.
Right.
You can't do that.
Mm-hmm. So, well, you could, but then they're going to send you to a special class probably.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be that kid.
What were you into pop culture-wise? Like, did you grow up with like American films, English films?
Yeah, all of them. We grew up with everything. I think that's what makes a lot of actors that come from overseas. There's an ability to morph into different people because we are just given an exposure to everywhere.
Yeah.
And growing up, obviously we were watching British TV, but we were on the kind of same things that everyone was on here in the States. You know, we were watching Sister Sister, Kenan and Kel, and Cousin Skeeter. Those are the things we used to watch.
Yeah.
You know, cartoons like Recess and all that kind of stuff. All the Disney movies back in the day. We all got all of that. But then at the same time, we've got our British shows, and
sure.
we've got shows from France, we've got shows from Australia, you know, like Home and Away and all this Neighbours and all right. this crazy.
Every Hemsworth
yeah,
was,
yeah.
was in
yeah.
your home.
Yeah, Hemsworth was in my house. I didn't know he was going to be Thor, but he was all the way up in my house.
We could see that
he lost his wife or something like that. Oh, he was going through some stuff at the time.
Yeah.
But
you knew he was going to emerge. He's 9 feet tall and the most handsome man on the planet. Yeah, he'll be okay.
I was like, he's sure he's going to do something. But we just had an exposure to so many things.
What about movie-wise? What was the first kind of first memories of movies or movie stars that kind of really?
I was born in '92. First movie I went to see was A Bug's Life by Pixar.
Sure.
That's the first movie I ever went to cinema to see.
See, I was more of like I'm much older than you, so I went with Ants, which was the big competitor that year.
Wow.
And it had Woody Allen going for it.
Yeah, what, that was the first movie you ever saw?
It wasn't my, oh my God. I was like 20-something by then.
I'm
saying that I remember that year, Pixar had a rival.
Ants came out the same year as Bug's Life.
It was a very bold move.
Who won?
Well, Bug's Life. Pixar always wins. Don't bet against Disney, as you well know.
I mean, I just said that just to hear. You know what I mean? It's a bit mad, yeah. That's the first time I went to see it. And it was a strange experience for me. It wasn't like inspirational. I was used to the theater. I was used to seeing my audience.
Yeah.
The screen was different to me. So I'm warmed up to that later on.
What about actors? Were there the first time that you kind of became obsessed with
actors? I didn't know what they did. Like, I just didn't really understand what they were there for. I mean, I understood they were part of the situation, but as a kid, I didn't know that it was like a job. They had agents and lawyers. I didn't know any of that. I just thought, yeah, these guys, this is a cool thing that they're doing, being involved in all of this. But I had no clarity as to how it worked.
So you were saying, so you went off to like an acting school then at some point. How old were you then?
When I went to identity, I joined at 16.
16.
Yeah.
So by then, were you like, this is my calling, I'm going to go all the way, and I think this is...
Well, before that, I was in theatre school. I was in Theatre Peckham, but that was specific to theatre.
Got it.
And I was there from the age of 10 up until I was 16.
Got it.
And then I went to a more kind of set institution. That's that institution, Identity Drama School, was
that's
for
the
me,
craft. That's the real stuff.
That's when you go in, you know, that's like medical school. That's when you go in like
technical,
this is what
stuff.
I want to do.
Right.
You know, it's the intricate part of learning how to be ready for the industry on like a serious note.
And when did the audition process for like Attack the Block happen? Were you out of school by then, or was that?
Oh, I was still there. I was still there, and I thought that was a great thing. I didn't go to the same kind of normal mainstream drama schools that most go to back in the UK. I went to a drama school that offered me opportunity.
I've heard this from other English actors where it's not even encouraged. You're not supposed to take jobs while you're in school.
They can leave that, number one. No. I was looking for a drama school that accepted that. So
like, wouldn't it hurt to actually get some experience while I'm here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta be on set. You gotta be doing as much as possible. This is not you know, studying. You're not studying to be a doctor, which you should probably stay away and read those books. But with acting,
there's no substitute for the actual experience.
Yeah, there's none whatsoever, and a set. They can't teach you how to be on set in drama school. They can't teach you that. You're dealing with so much different personalities and different ways of working. There's also a business element involved. There's so many dynamics to acting that has nothing to do with acting. Like this.
Sure. They don't teach you this in drama school?
No, they don't teach you it in drama school. But at this particular drama school I went to, it was clear to me that their intention was to have students who were also given the opportunity to work at the practical level, straight up, as ready as you are as an actor, you could work professionally, and I loved that. That motivated me because you know we wouldn't book you know the biggest roles, but you know I grew up around a bunch of actors who we all know today and see, you know, like Letitia Wright who's in Black Panther and Malachi Kirby who's in Black Mirror.
Yeah,
I grew up around all those guys. We were in the same class, and
amazing.
So, we used to book like little gigs and little TV shows and be like, wow, like this is cool. And we could bring that experience back to the classroom, share with other students. It was perfect.
So what did you, it sounds like you learned a hell of a lot probably on the set for Attack the Block. Mm-hmm. What, do you remember like kind of a rude awakening or certain things that kind of like blew your mind that you couldn't have experienced in drama school that is helpful to you to this day?
For me was schedule and how to keep the intention of a character alive despite the time of the night.
Right, right. Like, go back to your trailer for 6 hours, and then
yeah,
we need you, like,
night shift. We're waiting. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So you'd be in your trailer for a good few hours, and obviously I was like 16, 17 at the time. So instead of being in our trailers, you know, trying to get some shut-eye or some rest or preparing for the next scene, me and the rest of the boys were just looking through our phones, comparing girls. I mean, it would always be me and friends, just like, no, she's prettier than... No, she ain't prettier than yours. Yeah, she looks all right. And we'd just compare girls. Just be looking at girls, young boys.
Sure.
And so that's what we did. You know? And it was fun, but there was an element of okay, this is professional, like, this is real. And I was able to gain the best experience, and that really helped me with everything.
No one runs a publicity gauntlet like when you're promoting a Star Wars film.
Yeah, no.
But you got a taste of that on Attack the Block, at least going to Comic-Con and doing stuff like that.
Attack the Block done so well. I got to go to Hall H in Comic-Con. That's not...
Yeah,
I don't think there's an indie that's done that in a long time. That's a real big deal. Like, to
and
go
I'm sure
to
it
Hall
was
H.
received well. It's such a great film.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah.
So it's like... It was strange that I can say that Star Wars isn't the first thing that brought me to Comic-Con. It was Attack the Block, and then there was screenings all over LA. And it was funny, at the time, I was in LA already, and I wasn't really involved in the publicity.
Right.
I was staying at the Coral Sands Motel off of Hollywood Boulevard, and then
where all the high rollers go.
It was horrible. It was horrible, but I was staying there, you know, auditioning for stuff, and then suddenly Sony Screen Gems had bought Attack the Block and had chosen to distribute it in the States. And then all of a sudden I was in the Ritz-Carlton.
You get a magical upgrade.
Yeah, yeah. $100 a night on the room. I was like, wow. Upgrade.
This thing called per diem. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was per diem. And I was just like, wow. The film really just went from quiet to, people love it. And then we got... You know, distribution in select cities. It was really cool. Like, my dad gave me some suits to wear during interviews because I didn't own any suits. And it was dope, but it was a different time.
Did you like the publicity side? It seems like you enjoy this stuff. You get something out of it.
It's part of the business, and also it gives you a chance as an actor to kind of clarify a few things and let people know that this is not obviously it's fun to do, and looking from the outside in is a benefit, of course. But at the same time, it takes some real work, and it's nice to. Yeah. Give credit openly, you know?
Yeah.
It's nice.
So we talked a little bit about sort of like the close calls in those intermittent years between Attack the Block and some of the work, too, and Star Wars. But, like, were you confident? Did you have enough self-confidence and belief in yourself and just sort of whatever you want to call it, that you'd get to where you wanted to be? Were you worried that it wasn't going to... Were you ever worried it wasn't going to work out?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I just tell myself, shut up. I've got no choice. I'd rather die trying. But I mean, I had great experiences, even in terms of the opportunities that I didn't get. With Matthew Vaughn, I was able to work closely with him during the audition process. And then, you know, with The Maze Runner, I think it was Wes Ball that directed in that. And I got a chance to work. And all of that, despite the fact that I didn't get the role, served as a great opportunity.
Mm.
I can't lie, the role I did get, you know, just finished all of that.
Yeah, you're like, in retrospect,
I can't lie.
Kingsman's, you know, a good movie.
Yeah, no,
I'm
no,
good
it's
where
a good
I'm
film.
At.
It's a good film. And Taron is... Taron
he's
is
amazing.
Great. He's great in that film. He's great in those movies, and they're amazing in the Maze Runner films.
You guys would be fun together. You guys remind me of each other, just in terms of, like,
I feel like
you both can kind of do anything and have that similar kind of big personality.
Yeah, I think it's fun, and every time I see him, it's all love. And,
yeah.
But for me, I'm glad that, you know, he got that opportunity in a sense.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's not, you can't have them all, and that was, it's nice.
I missed you at D23, but I saw you there. That must be surreal, too, to also, like, be there on behalf of Star Wars, and also Letitia was there, probably, for
Black Panther. Black Panther. She came later.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's got to be... I mean, you're in with a pretty cool group. Not just Star Wars, but Disney. Have you?
Who, by the way, owns everything?
Yeah, they literally. Yeah, I'm saying that because I have to, because
they own the rights.
They own
the Bible?
12% of me now. Probably.
Do they?
I don't know. I don't know. Have you talked to them about any parts in their comic book films? There was talk of Black Panther. Was that just a rumor?
Yeah, that was back in a day when I didn't have any of the roles. I didn't have Star Wars, and at the time I was like, oh, they probably might want to do a Black Panther movie down the line. I'd love to do it.
Yeah.
But after you get something like Star Wars, it's like, yeah, you're not going to have Black Panther. You
know? I'm good with my franchise. I'm good.
Yeah, a bit too. Spread the love. Jesus.
But did you grow up with comic books? Was comic books a big thing?
Yep. Especially graphic novels. I remember the first time I went to a store that I really loved was with Joe Cornish and Edgar Wright. They took me, because they love comic books.
Yeah. So
they kind of schooled me a little bit, took me to Forbidden Planet in London and showed me all the stuff, the action figures. Till today, they have influenced me.
Nice.
I'm still addicted.
There's one here in New York. I've been to the Forbidden Planet here in New York. It's pretty good. The London one's probably better, to be honest. I've been to both, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I'll carve out some, cancel some interviews.
Yeah, I forget this is New York and it's a city of really great shopping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you worked here? Have you ever spent?
I did. While I was filming that pilot, I spent a long time here, but I was more in the Brooklyn area. Right?
Yeah. Because, yeah, I mean, London's still home, yes?
Yeah, still home, yeah.
I mean, I feel like I was, you know, I'm not the first to say it, but London and New York certainly.
Yeah, cousins, you know, feel like distant cousins, you know what I mean? But exactly. You guys, obviously, you know, big cousins. Yeah, one of those and fight, you know, fights the battles for us and
right,
stuff.
Right, right.
But yeah, I've enjoyed my time here, but I haven't had the time to shop.
You need to shop and you need to
I need to shop. This is New York. Come
and
on.
You need to do some theater. You just did some theater in the West End.
I would love to see Oscar Isaacs on stage as Hamlet.
It's a tough ticket. Get me in there, man. Come on, let's go. 4 hours. You ready?
Yeah. I might just audition to be his understudy. Just read off the paper. Try and see something.
That guy's pretty talented. He's all right.
No. He's obviously insanely talented and good looking. Very good looking guy.
Was it important, because you just wrapped up a production in London, again, like coming full circle to what we were starting in the beginning, like was it important to you to kind of like, because obviously you can make movies right now, you've got some cool opportunities, you don't need to go to the stage and do something like that and carve out a bunch of months.
Right.
Why was it important to do that, for instance, at this stage in your career, you think?
Because I'm in this for longevity. As long as my body is able, I want to act like for real.
Yeah.
I don't know, like the experience that I've had so far, there seems to be always a conversation about actors as people, you know, being as close to the characters that they play.
Right.
And I disagree with that. That's not there's no real art in that. You want to travel to a character that's so different from yourself, and that's the brilliance of acting. That's what makes us engaged. That's what kind of like we hail these actors as heroes, because they're able to just, you know, change their accents, the way in which they walk and talk. It's like, you know, Johnny Depp's greatest roles. It's like, you know, the stuff that Sidney Poitier was doing. It's just so different.
Yeah, you're Gary Oldman, Daniel Day-Lewis, that school, as opposed to
it's a beautiful thing. I think anybody can have access to that.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot more actors should do. I don't think it's the fact they're not talented. I just think that there's just a system now in which everyone just wants, you know, if you want to play an American, you have to be American. If you play British, you have to be British. And it's like, no, it's acting.
Well, it's also interesting, especially like at your age, I feel like that a lot of people don't give those kind of opportunities to somebody your age. Like they don't necessarily, there isn't the desire for whatever reason to see you transform. They just want to see you, you know, be like the good-looking leading man, whatever.
Yeah. But what's great is that, that's what's great about the opportunity that JJ gave me in Star Wars is that Finn is not necessarily your average looking, you know, your average leading man.
Sure.
It's a quirk and a tone to him even that just makes him, you know, a different kind of leading man.
Right.
And that's what I'm about. I like exploring the different intricate things about humanity that may not be, you know, the main story or the main event. That's what I'm about. So I've been given the opportunity to do so.
So you mentioned Finn. I can't believe we've spent this long without really diving into Star Wars a little bit. So let's talk a little bit. Just so that opportunity, and I still think of Force Awakens as kind of like a miracle, that it turned out like as amazingly as it did, like given just like the eyeballs
that were on it. $1 billion in 12 days?
Something crazy.
How many people did it take to make $1 billion in 12 days? Jesus Christ.
All you, just you, man.
Trust me, no.
But like, you know, and there were the stories, and I'm sure a lot of them were true, that like, you know, that was a fluid production. There was script was changing, characters were changing. Mm-hmm. There were some major changes in production, and yet somehow JJ pulled it all together.
Yeah.
I'm curious, like, when you started, was Finn a much different character? Like, what was the biggest difference from, like, day one to, like, the completion, or whenever you signed on to the completion of the film?
My first approach was playing Finn as quite stern and serious and, you know, blatantly heroic, because at the time, this was all the stuff I was going up for, you know, was the, you know, the stern, I'm going to save the day type dude. And JJ's the one that kind of filtered that down. It's kind of like, no, he's not that. He's a stormtrooper. He hasn't been given the opportunity to relate to people on a normal level. He's slightly over the top.
Right.
You know, he has behavioral issues. You know what I mean? And that's something that I gauged during the audition process, that the scenes work better, especially in terms of contrast to Daisy, when Finn is played in that way that JJ painted that for me.
Got it.
So it felt more natural, kind of establishing that connection, you know.
Did the Finn Poe relationship evolve? I mean, Poe was supposed to, as we know by now, was supposed to not even make it through the whole film.
I don't know what that was about, but I knew from when I auditioned with Oscar, and at the time I had booked the part already as Finn, and he was still trying to get to know. I just knew that they were going to have to extend it, because he's just, it doesn't make no sense.
Right.
He's just really good.
Yeah.
And I'm happy because, you know, Finn is also the middleman as well. He gets a chance to have these several different relationships. Finn and Han, Finn and you know, Rey, Finn and Poe, Finn and BB-8, Finn and Chewie. There's all these different dynamics, and I thought that that friendship that we built, that kind of brotherhood that we built in the movies, were just, it was really, really cool. And I know that fans want to see more of it.
Exactly.
I mean, in different ways, some fans.
They've got a good imagination.
Yeah, they got vision. I mean,
I got in trouble when I spoke to you at a celebration for calling it a bromance. People were like, "Don't call it a bromance, man. It's just, I don't know what they want me to call it. It's not a bromance. What do you want to call it? What should we call it?"
I call it a bromance, bro. Call it
what you okay, want, thank
man.
You. I've got your
let these people hold it back. Hold you back.
As you know, well, I was gonna say, I've spoken to Daisy about this too, about the social media thing. As you know, she like left Instagram.
Yes, she did. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, it's
well, she left Instagram while we were filming. I left as well.
Right.
We both left, and I know I was like, yeah, I'm gonna probably jump off it as well. It was a good time to just kind of detach from all of that.
Yeah, I mean, and she, and I'm sure you've experienced that. Anybody that's moderately in the public eye experiences a lot of crazy stuff out there.
Of course, yeah.
What's the coping mechanism? Is there one to kind of keep your brain in check, your sanity from all the noise that's out there?
Not really, man. I'm a London boy.
You can take it. You're fine.
I mean, people can say what they want, but the reason why they're talking about you is because you're in that position, not them.
Right.
And that's the role that they choose to play in this circle of life. Like, you know, even if the people that type and write negative comments or send negative tweets, if they were famous, if they were in that position, they would get a fair amount of negativity too. It's just the way things work. And for me, it's not necessarily deep.
Right.
You know, so emotionally, I am able to kind of maneuver those things. And sometimes I have fun with it.
Yeah. Do you poke back if someone?
Oh, yeah. I clap back from time to time. I have no shame when it comes to that. Because don't be telling me celebrities. There are some comments that you do see on your social media. And you have to give them a little, you know, you can't just be messing with me anyhow.
We were talking about the amazing friendships that you cultivated on that set. You and Harrison had a fun time together. Mm-hmm. At least you did. I don't know if Harrison had a fun time.
He had an amazing time.
How many times?
He had a straight face, but I knew in the spirit he felt great.
How many times has he changed his number on you since production ended?
Oh, he hasn't, because my career has actually been doing well, so he has to keep my number now.
He needs you now.
He might need me. He might need me for some form of a spin-off.
Would you fly with him at this point?
No. I wouldn't. That's why I don't send him emails regularly, because I don't want him to say, "Hey, let's take a flight on the plane." Like,
I'm just gonna take a train on this one.
Yeah,
I'm good.
Bro, I am not going on no plane with Harrison Ford, especially if he's in that pilot seat, and he knows I've said that many
he's
times.
Pushing
in his
luck. Come on, man.
It's not gonna happen. I think he's really cool, but he can be cool by himself in that plane.
Exactly.
Nah, No.
All right, let's dance around a little bit of Last Jedi, which I know you can't talk about, but just out of curiosity, I know Mark Hamill talked about how like that script kind of like surprised him in many ways, and where that character went. Did it surprise you? Like, here's my first question: do you read the whole script at first, or in kind of chunks? Like, how do they deliver it to the principal performers like you? Are you able to read it all at once, or?
Well, I was kind of shocked that nothing had changed. I was still in the room of, you know, reading the full script, you know, at Pinewood Studios. I didn't get to take it home.
You're like, come on, now I'm
like, come on, guys. Like, seriously, when do we get into the club? Maybe 9. But this time it was the same process. We called into the studio, we read it in the room. I read the whole script, knowing that you don't get a chance to take it home.
So are you writing notes for yourself on the side, or are you just kind of like, what are you doing?
But I think with 8 specifically, because of there's more dialogue, especially for Finn, I had to learn on the go in certain scenes.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, but next time I wouldn't take those notes.
What's that noise in the room?
Nothing?
It's
fine. It's fine, Colin. It's fine.
We've joked or not joked about Finn and Poe. How are Finn and Phasma doing? Because they have a history too.
I mean, yeah, it's not great. I can't believe she's back. I read that script like, where the hell did she come from?
Can't keep Gwendolyn down.
Yeah, she's like Team Rocket from Pokemon. They just blast off, and they come back the next episode for some reason. But I think it's cool. I think there's some conversations between them to be had. And the last time they saw each other, Finn wanted her, made sure that she was in a binge shoot, so I'm not sure how she feels about that.
When do you get to see the movie? And do you get a plus one?
I don't know. I have no idea. I'm telling you, like, we are so in your shoes at this point.
At this point, process. We're on like, an even process. You know that much more than me.
I mean, that's what's so different about working on other projects, whereas you are involved. And this is just like, which is cool. You get to be part of the audience. Yeah. You get to be surprised by trailers. What surprises them as much as you? We don't get to see anything. So,
is there something you've communicated to Kathy Kennedy or Colin that you need to see Finn do before episode 9 is over?
I haven't communicated. Colin came to see my play, and we met briefly at the stage door, and I was so, like, the play is intense. I didn't get that time to sit down and chat. But for me, I would love to... I think, as all fans, we want to just know where everybody fits in now, you know? Like, we just want to know... Okay, who's the Jedi? Ray's the Jedi. Who's the gunslinger? We just want, you know, specific.
Right. You want the answers.
Yeah, we just want all the answers. Who are the parents? Second names, everything. you know, we'll see. We'll see what they're planning to do. And they know what they're doing over there.
What do you think, as a fan, should happen after episode 9? Like, because it sounds like they're still figuring it out. Like, whether, like, they continue with saga films or if they just go on.
After 9, I mean, it depends what they do. But I think... I think, continue the saga films, why not? Continue them, but obviously a few years between 9 and 10, but you should, if they were going to, that would be really cool. It was worth it.
Speaking of big movies, I just spent time with your dad, Idris Elba.
Yes, Idris.
You gotta do an Idris, come on. my Idris is Josh.
You sound like Churchill, man. I sound like no Idris, bro.
Idris, he's the man, as you know. He's dope, so cool. Yeah. The coolest man on the planet. And he, you're playing, I mean, your character is his son, yes, in Pacific Rim. Yeah. Uprising, is that what, do I have that right?
Yeah, Uprising, yeah.
So not only are you in this, you're producing Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
That's your first film as a producer.
Yeah, first one. I mean, I've done a few short films back in the day, but...
That's a big jump, though. What I was going to say is, like, I mean, talk about ambition. Like, you know, that's a big leap as a producer to just, like, give me a sense of just sort of why, how that came about and why that was something you wanted to kind of put all your muscle behind.
Well, I used the money I earned on 7 to just set up a company and hire a few people to join me on this venture, because I just realized that creative control is something that I want.
Yeah.
I want the ability to be able to cast myself in the movies that I want to be a part of. And also I feel like being an actor and a producer helps you understand, you know, there's a two separate worlds there, and for some reason there's a balance in which I felt that needed to be met, and someone like me who has that kind of duo personality, I just wanted to be behind the scenes as well as in front of the camera, and we were just looking for, we read many projects all the time, and we were just looking for something to just kickstart that experience in a crazy way. And it just so happened that I was like, you know what, guys, I'm not close to another franchise. And so it was like, well, this is a great way to also combine your aspirations as a producer. And Legendary came about. I have a great relationship with Kale Boyd, our married parent, and we all kind of sat down and decided that we were going to do this. And my company was just like, yeah, let's do it.
As you know, it's a tough act to follow someone like Guillermo's vision on the first one, and that's a
beautiful vision, epic. And one that we don't ignore, you know.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, can you tease a little bit in terms of, like, time that's passed? Like, what the
tease? I'll read you the script.
Because I assume we're going to start to see some footage pretty soon.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw, like, a little viral video thing that you recorded recently.
We're working on that, but we still have some special effects stuff to do. And
so what's the world? What's the character?
I play Jake Pentecost, who's been, you know, away during Pacific Rim 1. He's kind of like the prodigal son who never came back.
Got it.
And he's now given a chance and opportunity to join the PPDC and earn his right to be there. But it's not all as it seems. We have, obviously, the breach was closed in Pacific Rim, but there are other ways of doing things.
Okay.
For these kaiju, they are very, very intelligent, and they're coming back hard. So what do we do? Upgrades.
Upgrades.
Oh, yeah.
Dramatic pause.
Upgrades. Some of which came from here. So don't worry, nerds. Everything you wanted, I made sure to inject into this. It's really cool. Some really cool stuff going down.
Have you been boning up on any new impressions as you about to embark on your Star Wars press for the next few months? You better get something ready, man.
I haven't, because, you know,
they're going to ask for Yoda and Chewbacca. They're going to ask for all.
I'm in more critical acclaimed projects. This Detroit time.
No one's asking for a Captain Bigelow impression.
No one's asking for that. No. But maybe now I should. I should start.
I'm just planting that in your head.
Yeah, that's right.
When next we meet.
The Star Wars fans. A whole list of new characters has to happen.
Yeah, got to go deep. I mean, all I'm saying is I did a video once with Benedict Cumberbatch. I think it was 11 impressions in a minute. I think you can beat it.
He said 11 impressions. I can beat that.
All right. When next we meet.
When next we meet.
Congratulations on the film.
Thank you
honestly,
so much, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You know, any opportunity to work with someone like Catherine, it's a special one. I mean, she's top of my list, and I'm sure top of yours. And,
yes.
And you really made the most of it, man.
Thank you, sir.
Good to see you, as always.
Good to see you, man.
Thanks, buddy.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.